One Lincolnshire farmer won gold at the recent Yield Enhancement Network Awards. How did he do it?
We got them drilled in good time and those up and away. We used the BioNature product from the start with the early delta, and that got us great root structure and the biomass, more delta along through the way, and then obviously the cow fucks later on in the programme. It certainly worked well for us.
How do we get new entrants into agriculture? How do they make it successful? How do they fund it? And if you're thinking of retiring, how do you hand over to the next generation?
Working out how young people could get into agriculture, and was succession blocking them? And too often they were. The succession plans were not developed and nobody had the confidence to know where they stood within their family farm.
We'll check the markets and get a crop update and some important agronomy advice.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
Good morning. Hope you've had a good week. We'll start with congratulations to Lincolnshire farmer Mark Popplewell, who's won gold at the 2025 Yield Enhancement Network Awards for a record-breaking oat yield of 11.46 tonnes a hectare. So I went to meet Mark at Happy Days Farming at Nettleham and Mark Carter from BioNature to find out how he did it.
Well, I think we got a great variety with Cope Seeds, with the Merlin. We got them drilled in good time and those up and away. And then obviously we kept feeding them. I'm a big believer in the nutrition program, and we used the BioNature product from the start with the early delta, and that got us got us great root structure and the biomass, more delta along through the way, and then obviously the cow fucks later on in the program, and it certainly worked well for us.
When you say you got them in early, up and away, you followed a rather wet spring, didn't you?
It followed a very wet spring. The land that the oats came on was actually destined for winter wheat. Obviously didn't get them drilled, so our farm at Nettleham is our kindest land, so we got them in as early as we could. It was the first job we did. It didn't make any difference to the yield. We had three drills drilling them, Vardastat Rapid, the Weaving Sabertine and the Horse Avatar, and there was no difference in yield across the three drills. And also across ploughed land and some that was direct drilled, the yield was pretty much the same. And in odd spots in the field, the combine was spotting at 14 tonnes.
The achievement of the yield is fantastic, but has it been affected by what you've had to spend to get that yield? Is it still viable?
At the end of the day, we farm to make profit. I don't farm to go to the Yield Enhancement Network Awards sort of thing. So I would think, if you look at our fungicide spend, for an example, £46, our nutrition spend, yeah, I think it's very viable. And across our just over 2,000 hectares, the oats will definitely be our best margin crop this year.
Returning to Mark Carter now from BioNature UK, from a nutrition point of view, what had to be done to achieve this?
What had to be done, Steve? We had to feed the crop little and often. And what we have is some cutting edge nutrition products that are gaining ground in the UK at a real pace. Mark, he embraces the product especially, and has learnt to understand that the Delta product, liquid product, all of our products liquid, comes in an NH2 form. So it's delivered straight into the leaf, which is the response that these farmers want to see. So that you're getting a larger root mass, a thicker stem, a healthier crop, and more tillers. And once you've created this plant, you then have to feed it. So what we did with the oats, we fed the oats with timings that were that fitted in with Mark, with other products. And we helped to achieve this yield with just under a £50 a hectare spend.
Mark, just talk to me about the soil. What kind of soil were we going into? Is it particularly good? Is it particularly easy?
Nettleham is quite our easiest working farm, I must admit. Some bits I've got a little bit stronger. Not a lot of depth of soil here. We're farming on a mixture of cropping techniques. Currently, we're ploughing 1 in 5 years, we're direct drilling, and we're min tilling. So we're not just doing one thing, we're sort of like, you know, having to go in all areas, really.
Another man who knows a thing or two about crops is our independent agronomist, Sean Sparling, here with some timely agronomy advice for us. Morning, Sean.
Yes, morning, Steve. Talk about a week of two halves. 4 degrees at best early week, frosty nights. I was down to -3 overnight into Tuesday. But then from Thursday onwards, a whole lot warmer. Got up to the heavy heights of 15 degrees in the day, Thursday and Friday, and still into double figures overnight into Saturday. We've had a bit of the wet, drizzly stuff too, of course. Snizzle, actually, on Sunday afternoon, that mix of snow and drizzle. But the rain hasn't really amounted to as much as would have caused massive problems through the end of the week, although 1 or 2 mils in already sticky wet field conditions is just about as disruptive as an inch on some of those wet ones. But it's been proper windy as well too since Thursday, and with that bit of sunshine, the warmer weather, that wind, those warming overnight temperatures, the spring dragon seems to be being poked into waking up. And the first signs of a bit of drying weather for spring 25 got underway as well. Over 350 mil of rain for me since the beginning of October, and you can almost count the number of drying days we've had since the start of December on the fingers of 1 foot. So February Fildyke it most certainly hasn't been so far, but nor is it dried out much either. And with 44 nights out of the 53 we've had so far this year having been cold enough for a frost with me, that'll be why, because the frosts tend to keep things sticky. So nitrogen and sulphur applications, the order of the day on the oilseed rape. Rape a priority as well from a sulphur point of view. Assuming you've still got some oilseed rape left out there once the pigeons, hares, rabbits, deer, stem weevil, flea beetle have all had their fill. But do get out there with your Stanley knives and check any areas if they're thinning or starting to go backwards. Check those stems. Just take care not to slash your finger open and need 5 stitches like I did on Monday. The sulphur takes 4 to 5 weeks to get into the plant in a form that the rape plant can actually use. It goes up in through the roots and converts. And sulphur needs to be in place and available at the onset of stem extension in about 5 weeks or so time. But because of the cold weather we've had so far this year, even the better oilseed rape crops are barely starting to wake up. But the buds are starting to make an appearance now in some of those forward bits. So do monitor these crops carefully, not least if you've still got herbicides to put on. You need to know your latest crop growth stage cutoff timings for clopyrrolid, picloram, bifenox, haloxifen, methyl and all of those. Light leaf spot levels remain low, and remember you only get about 3 weeks protection against any further spread with a fungicide. You don't control it, but as the weather turns growy, then the light leaf spot is starting to grow too, and that is your cue to get fungicides on as things warm up. If it stays cold, that will probably hold it better than you can with a fungicide, so just let the conditions guide you, but cold weather means don't panic. Nitrogen and sulphur going on to winter wheat and winter barleys as well. I know it's still only February, but it's the growth that guides us, and it wants applying once the crop's growth gets underway. There are still an awful lot of sleepy fields out here, and the soil's barely above 5 now. They've gone up from below 3 early in the week, so again, no real panic on that. But once again this year, sulphur likely to have been leached out of those seed beds too, so that'll need addressing. Cereals respond to about 50 kilos or so of sulphate, but most of the cereal crops not really showing any widespread nitrogen or sulphur deficiencies as yet, because they haven't really woken up. They're still blue by the winter and not really awake. But know what you're looking at. If the new growth you see is darker green than the paler green older leaves, it'll be nitrogen deficiency. Sulfur deficiency shows in the new leaf first, so a plant with darker green older leaves but a paler new growth is almost certainly going to be sulfur deficient. But it is early doors, as I say. Wait until things wake up and start to grow away and look hungry, then as travelling becomes possible, crack on with a bit of that. Yellow rust and septoria fairly widespread, as I said last week, but way too soon for fungicide. Spring growth barely underway, and any suggestion of T-0 just smacks of desperation to me, and will certainly be of way more benefit to the company supplying it than you or your crops. And we've seen an increase also, don't forget, in snake oil salesman activity at this time of year over the last few seasons. So just be prepared for all sorts of magic elixirs and all-round miracle pick-me-ups to be thrust at you through the media. To be frank, you know, a bit of drier, warmer weather is probably the order of the imminent future, and don't be told otherwise. If you are desperate to get some nitrogen on your wheats, then urea is going to be better than ammonium nitrate in these cold, wet soils, because it's not going to leach through. It doesn't need a urease inhibitor, as I said last week, until after the end of March. And do bear in mind that it's been pretty wet since these crops went in, so the root systems are pretty shallow, with crops not having to look for water since they went in. So just watch the weather forecast. If it suddenly comes cold and wet on fields that have had 60 kilos of ammonium nitrate applied, there's likely to be a whooshing noise as that nitrate washes through and out of reach faster than the crop can get hold of it. Crops have had a hard winter to get over before they start to tackle the hard spring that lies ahead of them. And there are plenty of slump soils. They have been, and indeed many still are, waterlogged. There have been leaching losses to nitrogen and sulphur levels in particular over the winter, as well as the microelements. There'll have been denitrification and damage to soil microbiology if they've sat wet and underwater in prolonged periods in some fields. So very important that any interventions that we make are beneficial to the crop, they're cost effective, and above all, they actually work. It's all about timing. So this time of year in particular, regular field walking and constant monitoring of the crops and the conditions, that's the thing that's going to guide us and give us the most effective spend. Because from now to growth stage 30, it's crucial for root establishment, the maintenance of leaves, shoots and tillers, for these plants to optimise overall biomass so that they're ready for that rapid period of bulking once stem extension gets underway in a few weeks' time. So let's hope that March behaves more like a lamb than a lion when it gets here in a few days' time. And let's see what the next 7 days bring.
Thanks as ever, Sean. How to retire, how to hand the farm to the next generation, how to attract new entrants into farming, all topics discussed at the recent Lincolnshire Farming Conference. Hear the thoughts of farmer and chair of Dyson Farming, David Fursden, next.
The Week in Agriculture. This is the Farming Programme with Steve Orchard.
The recent Lincolnshire Farming Conference took the theme of inspiring the next generation. But how do you attract them? How do they get started? How do they raise the funding? And if you're an existing farmer looking to retire, how do you go about handing it to the next generation? The thoughts of farmer and chair of Dyson Farming, David Fursden, who opened the conference.
Well, I think the industry talks about succession much more than it used to. And what I found was that there were a lot of people talking about it. Some of them were at seminars that were funded by lawyers who wanted the business. But there were some that were much more open-minded about it. When I was invited to do the Future of Farming Review in 2013, that I got quite involved in succession there and working out how young people could get into agriculture, and was succession blocking them. And too often they were. The succession plans were not developed and nobody had the confidence to know where they stood within their family farm. So bringing new young blood into the industry was being blocked by families. And so we did a lot of work on succession and what could unlock that. And I think that's where I started, and started applying those lessons at home as well.
So on a practical basis, what was the first step? Did you get everybody around the table, or how did you do that?
First of all, you have to really accept the fact that you are going to move on. So that takes a while, because, oh no, I'll just stay and do something else. I've always wanted to do that to the farm. So you have to really be certain. And once you're really certain, and it helps to have a wife who says, this is definite. And we set ourselves a date when we were going to be out by. And I think that's really helpful, because you work to that date. I talked to the family. By the time we got towards our date, and one, i.e. the eldest, had agreed that he would do it, that was a one-to-one conversation and not an easy one. But once we had decided that, then the path was set and we stuck to that deadline and we went when we said we were going to go.
And you started having regular family meetings, not around the kitchen table kind of thing, family meetings, but proper formal business meetings.
Had to be a business meeting. The trouble is the kitchen is that, you know, somebody goes to boil the kettle and make a coffee, or somebody comes to the door and you go and answer it, and there isn't the focus. This was a proper business meeting, uninterrupted, everybody there, everybody being asked their opinion, and everyone expected to give their opinion, not sitting back and leaving it to others. And so we got everything out on the table, and that was really, I think, the most important bit for us.
And you got other people involved, not just the family. You actually brought in third parties to these meetings.
I think you have to have another opinion from somebody else who you respect. And if a third party can come in and say, well, everybody else is doing this, this actually works, I've seen it happen, and yes, you can make it happen here, that is a much more convincing argument to your children than you telling them that, because they always suspect that you've got a vested interest in the outcome, and they like to hear it from somebody who doesn't have that vested interest.
So who did you bring to the meetings?
Brought a solicitor. No, we had a solicitor in the background. He didn't come to the meetings. We had an accountant who translated the accounts that we were looking at to explain what they really meant. And we had a land agent who had experience of farms like ours, but had worked with lots of other people and said, yes, these are the things that people are doing. This is why the business plan looks good. And this, I really wouldn't do that, even if you think it's right, because of X, Y, and Z. And they were respected. They had to be respected third parties, but the kids respected those third parties and listened to what they had to say, and that made a massive difference.
So having made your decision to move on, you start planning, you start training the next generation. And that brings me on to thinking about opportunities for the next generation. You made part of your farm available. You carried out lots of interviews. You got people to come along and maybe pitch why they should be involved and why they should take on your farm. One of the comments you made during your presentation was that you found a lot of financial illiteracy. What did you mean by that?
So people's business plan that they presented to us for how they were going to farm the farm and how they were going to afford the rent just didn't stack up. They had unrealistic yields. They had unrealistic lambing percentages. And when you quizzed them on it, you realised that what they'd done is they'd done it back to front. They'd looked at, they talked to their land agent, who said, well, the rent for this is going to be so much an acre. And they thought, how do we get to so much an acre? And so they over-egged the performance of their farming to try and meet that rental figure that they were going to offer. And of course, you can't put all the money into the rent, because you have to actually have repairs and running costs and so on, as one knows in a business. So what they hadn't done, these people had not really talked through the business side of what they were doing with somebody who really knew about these things. And it just didn't make sense.
So inject a certain amount of realism into any plans that you might have.
You'll get somebody else to ask a few questions who's a third party and say, well, what do you mean by this, before you come to the interview?
And you talked about access to capital. One of the questions that was asked of you was about access to capital if somebody's wanted to get into the business for the first time. It's not an easy thing to do, but you can prepare for that if you're working somewhere else and learning that business.
Well, there are two things. One is, if you work somewhere else, you understand how that business works. I've suggested that you can probably build a profile of your performance working for that other business, which could be translated into, if you like, your own profit and loss account that you can take with you. But also the advantage is that you can start to put some capital aside if you live frugally when you're working in this other business. And so at least you've got a bit of a nugget there to start off. So you're not trying to find 100% of the capital from the bank. I mean, you're just not going to get lent 100% of your capital. It won't happen. So you have to actually, you know, it's like getting a mortgage on a house.
So don't expect to have the idea, I want to get a farm, I want to be a first generation farmer, and go straight into getting your farm. Go and work somewhere else first, learn the industry, build up some capital, then look at moving into your own place.
That's how people build their careers if they're not in farming. And they're working. If you're working in industry, you're working in a business of some sort, you actually take steps up, you get promoted, you increase your annual salary, and gradually you're in a get to a position where you can probably go off on your own. The same is true in farming.
Is there anywhere that somebody could go for advice? If somebody's a brand new young person in their 20s thinking, I would like to get into a farm, I don't have a farming background, where can they go to find out all this stuff?
Very difficult. There's a new organisation that's been set up called TIAH, T-I-A-H, the Institute of Agriculture and Horticulture. And that's been set up in order to try and help people do just that. It's also to do professional development for people already in agriculture. And that is all about skills and advice. And new entrants is a very strong part of that.
David, thank you for talking to me on the Farming Programme about this and helping to inspire the next generation.
Thank you very much.
Plenty more from the next generation in the coming weeks on The Farming Programme.
The Farming Programme.
Market reports.
Starting with livestock and from Louth Market, good morning to auctioneer Edward Middleton.
Good morning, Steve. This week, prime heifers all in average 364.58 pence per kilo. Prime steers all in averaged 345.58 pence per kilo, and prime bulls all in averaged 345. Top price in the bulls came from J.E. Thirlby of Kexby at 345 pence per kilo, or £2,242.50. Top price in the steers came from G.S. Paul of Burrell Marsh at 372 pence per kilo. In the heifers, topping the pence per kilo were F. Wallace and Son of Biscothorpe at 387 pence per kilo. And in the pounds per head, GL and M. Carr of Skidbrook topped at £2,509. On to the cull cows, an average this week of 204.99 pence per kilo. And topping for J.E. Thirlby of Kexby at 248 pence per kilo for an 18-year-old Limousin cow. Moving on to the store cattle. Store steers this week all in average £1,621.18. And store heifers all in average £1,570. Top price in the steers came from Ryby Grange Farming Company of Grimsby, topping at £1,860 for a 12-month-old Limousin steer. And then the top in the heifers was C.A. Oliver of Ashby by Partney, topping at £1,900, again for a 12-month-old British Blue heifer. Moving on to the sheep, this week we had an SQQ of 324.19 pence per kilo and an all-in average pounds per head of £148.46. Top price this week came from C.A. Mottram and Sons of Lincoln, topping the day's trading at £180 twice for some 59 Texel crosses. H. Smith and Sons of Theddlethorpe topped the pence per kilo at 364 pence per kilo and sold to a top of £177. On to the cull ewes, an average this week of £146.41. On to the store lambs, an average of £96.41. Longer keep lambs in the £80 to the £100 bracket. I'm Edward Middleton, auctioneer at Louth Livestock Market.
Thanks, Edward. To the grain markets now with Open Fields, Alice Killam. Morning, Alice.
Good morning, Steve. It's been a rather disappointing second half of the week. Markets flirted with us late on Tuesday night. We were all hoping to hit some target numbers early on Wednesday morning, but the market had other ideas. November futures fell back off to circa 197 to 198 for much of Wednesday and Thursday. The US market, which is what everybody else was riding on the back of, has just checked in the last couple of days. Some disappointing wheat export numbers is enough to stall the funds who had started to buy back some of their short position. Corn export numbers are good again though, and it is this, with funds supporting it with healthy buying, which is keeping us all interested globally. The last time funds were this long, they maintained this position for 4 to 6 months respectively, so it's not a given that they are going to sell anytime soon. Let's hope that this is the case. To global weather then, it's still cold in the US and in Russia, but a couple of reports that I've read in the last couple of days seem to suggest that for now, this has been built into the values. There is not enough evidence of winter kill at present to push this story on. Disappointing, I maintain that this is our best chance for any sensible rally around the globe. Back in France and the UK, we are left very much as we were. The driver for any better values is clearly new crop. The French Retief market, which has risen to levels last seen in October, with London at a slight premium to the French, some would argue it is this market that we are trying to chase. A breather for now, but don't give up just yet on new crop. The old crop market is front and centre of most people's thoughts though, and this is becoming a larger concern. May 25, which is the only position with any open interest, is finding few friends. It is one of the reasons that the old crop May and new crop November is getting wider. But with those who hold the futures trying to exit their positions and consumers who are using May futures as their buying guide drop their values every time futures fall, it's not been a fun week. The top of the range, remember, is 195, and there are some analysts who feel that we will get back to this level, but we currently sit towards the very bottom of the 185 to 195 range, and the clock is ticking. We did see this happen last season, though the fall started a month earlier. Either way, it's a worrying trend. The import numbers from Tuesday did illustrate a slowdown in business from November to December, but we need this to continue if old crop is going to see any kind of bounce in the final quarter of the season. A jump in new crop would also help and would drag the old crop up with it a little. Keep an eye on the spread. It currently sits at £11.25 per tonne. Fingers crossed we find some more inspiration next week. To the guide prices for this week, circa Friday morning. Feed wheat, February 175 to 185, April 180 to 190, May 182 to 192. Feed barley, February 150 to 160, April 155 to 165, and May 157 to 167. Oilseed rape, February 430 to 440, May 435 to 445, and finally feed beans, April 215 to 225, and May 220 to 230. As usual, please do call for firm values.
Thanks, Alice.
The Farming Programme. 5-day forecast.
A windy start to the week with southerly gusts up to 50 miles per hour today, bringing rain later and staying warm into Monday with highs of 11 and staying much the same overnight. Mostly dry for the rest of the week as it turns colder again with highs of 7 or 8 Celsius and down to 2 or 3 overnight. The winds ease considerably after Tuesday to be light and variable. Plenty of sunshine during the week as the pressure stays around normal levels. A few dates for your diary before we go. There's another inheritance tax protest rally in London on Pancake Day, Tuesday, March the 4th. Tractors into Schools Week starts tomorrow. And later this morning, there's a charity tractor run starting at Lincolnshire Showground at 10 and passing through many of the local villages. It's raising funds for Lives and the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society. All you need to know is at lincolnshireshowground.co.uk. And the 2025 European Ploughing Championships are on next week, 1st and 2nd of March in Nottinghamshire. Ian Dawson at Waldmarsh. Tell us more.
It's all forms of ploughing. Fascinating. Shire horse categories where competitors are ploughing the old-fashioned way with the Shire horses, which is absolutely fabulous to watch. And then we move on to vintage tractors, you know, with 2, 3, 4 ploughs, that sort of thing, and very high standard of competition. Also, there's quite a variety of trade stands in ancillary industries connected with farming.
Okay, and just remind us of where it is, when it is, and where could we find out more about it?
Yeah, so it's at Upper Moreton, Retford, Nottinghamshire, DN228HG, by kind permission of Joseph Cam Farms Limited. It's on Saturday and Sunday, the 1st and 2nd of March.
Thanks, Ian. Full details at ploughmen.co.uk. Next week, we'll look ahead to the latest Low Carbon Ag Show, get an update on the work of the Lincolnshire Rural Support Network, and visit one of the schools welcoming a tractor to the playground this week. I'm Steve Orchard. Until then, have a great week.